Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The fact that Frederick Douglass, a former slave and an outspoken proponent of abolitionism, owned a statuette of Hiram Powers, the Greek slave, raises difficult questions. Speaking at the second annual John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art, held on March 23, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Tess Korobkin highlights other examples of reproductions of the sculpture in a range of media to explore more fully the layered and sometimes contradictory political materialities of Powers' work. The John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art is made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
In 1895, when Frederick Douglass died in his Cedar Hill home in Anacostia, Washington, D.C., a 19-inch statuette of Hiram Powers' Greek slave was among his belongings. A photograph of Douglass's home at the time of his death shows the statuette displayed on the piano in the informal West Parlor. In another image from a few years earlier, it peeks out from behind Douglass at his desk in Haiti, where he served as Consul General in the early 1890s. The fact that Douglass prominently displayed this Greek slave statuette in his home and took it with him to Haiti marks its importance to him. Yet we have no record of Douglass's thoughts about the statue. What did it mean to Douglass, a man born into slavery who became the greatest orator, writer, and reformer of the American abolitionist movement and a lifelong advocate for the rights of African Americans and women, to own a reproduction of this iconic figure of an enslaved woman? Today, I will approach Douglass's encounter with the Greek slave from two angles. First, I consider the Greek slave as an icon in the public sphere, where Powers' large-scale marbles, as we learned there were six, elicited complex and contradictory responses from the abolitionist movement of the 1850s, of which Douglass was a critical leader. Second, I consider the Greek slave as a specific object in Douglass's home. His statuette is merely one example of reproductions of the sculpture in an astonishing array of media, including prints, calotypes, daguerreotypes, stereoviews, statuettes, and even textiles. Produced for the private domestic spaces of the home, these objects shaped intimate encounters with the Greek slave for vast and varied Victorian audiences. Through a daguerreotype, a picture, and a quilt, I ask what such sculptural reproductions said about the Greek slave at the level of their materials, form, and tactile experience. Finally, I return to Douglass's statuette to consider what his particular reproduction might tell us about its meanings. The Greek slave became an iconic work catapulted to international fame and popularity at London's Great Exhibition of 1851. Critics extolled the sculpture as an artistic achievement of the highest order, remarking on its overwhelming beauty and evocative naturalism. As the centerpiece of the American exhibition, the statue was lauded as a specimen of American progress among industrialized nations on the world stage. The figure was also praised as an icon of Christian virtue and feminine modesty. As was widely known, the statue represents a Christian woman captured during the Greek War of Independence in the 1820s and displayed for sale in a Turkish slave market. Although the statue's naturalistic nudity was shocking and even controversial for some Victorian audiences, as we have heard, others argued the figure was clothed in Christian piety and called forth in the moral viewer only feelings of horror and condemnation of slavery. Commentators immediately recognized the statue's implicit connection to the millions of people laboring under chattel slavery in the United States, as well as the ways it obfuscated the racial dynamics of that system of enslavement. A widely reprinted cartoon in the British magazine Punch satirized the Greek slave as a disavowal of American slavery and more pointedly its racial structure. John Tenniel depicts a black female figure in the pose of the sculpture, her lower half covered in drapery and her hands shackled to a post draped in the American flag. The caption reads, "The Virginian Slave, intended as a companion to Power's Greek Slave." Douglas was certainly aware of the Greek slave's complex and contradictory relationship to the movement for abolition of American slavery. In 1850, he published a letter in his North Star paper from a fellow abolitionist who had seen one of Power's marble originals on tour in Rochester, New York, and described it as a potent icon of injustice, one that condemned all slave mongers, quote, be their names Hassam, Salim, James, Judas, or Henry, their country Algiers or Alabama, Congo or Carolina, the same. Douglas also knew of the widely publicized protest by formerly enslaved activists William Wells Brown and William and Ellen Craft just 1 year earlier at the site of the statue's display in London. Brown and the Crafts joined with white British reformers to walk through the Great Exhibition arm in arm, loudly discussing slavery. When they arrived at the sculpture, Brown deposited the Punch cartoon within the railing, declaring, "As an American fugitive slave, I place this Virginian slave by the side of the Greek slave as its most fitting companion." For this anti-slavery group, the sculpture demanded active performance to claim it as a site for the abolitionist cause. Some abolitionists found the figure to be an affecting condemnation of slavery. To others, as an emphatically white, ideal body, the Greek slave dangerously obscured slavery's racialized reality, leaving anti-black racism intact. Operating within and fostering these discussions, Douglas surely understood both the utility and the deficiency of the Greek slave as a symbol for the abolitionist movement. I turn now to the private display and consumption of the Greek slave in Victorian homes, Douglas's among them, and what we might call the political materiality of such sculptural reproductions. Domestic objects such as this daguerreotype, pitcher, and coverlet offered intimate encounters with the Greek slave as desirable as desirable commodities representing a popular work of art. We cannot assume that their makers or consumers set out to make an explicit political statement. Indeed, although the Greek slave was a central figure of political debate in the mid-19th century, in many American contexts, the sculpture carried no abolitionist valence at all. In the years before the Civil War, Power's full-scale marble replicas were displayed to acclaim in southern cities, such as New Orleans, and reproductions were popular on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. Godey's Ladies' Book, a studiously unpolitical magazine, recommended that a statuette of Power's figure, like the one Douglas owned, quote, should be found on the toilette of every young lady. This disconnection is powerfully captured on a single page of the Annapolis Gazette, published in Maryland in December 1854. The top of page 3 advertises the Greek slave as a raffle prize for the Cosmopolitan Art Association. At the bottom, an announcement runs for the sale, quote, Friday the 12th day of January next, of a Negro woman named Nellie, about 20 years of age, a slave for life. This page demonstrates the profound separation and absolute connection between the circulation of the sculptural body of an enslaved woman and the bodies of real women trafficked as commodities in the American system of enslavement. Whether acknowledged or evaded, in 1850s America, slavery always constituted an inevitable part of the Greek slave's cultural significance. As a group, these domestic objects allow us to see the relationship of the Greek slave to American slavery in different terms than the public discourse around the full-scale replicas. By virtue of the sensuous experience afforded by their form, scale, materiality, these objects, like the page in the Annapolis Gazette, map implicit links between the shackled sculptural body and the bodies of enslaved people. The erotics of viewing the daguerreotype, the racialized discourse of purity underpinning the color scheme in the picture, and the celebration of industrial modernity in this coverlet all inflect and illuminate connections between Power's statue and American slavery. The sensational victimization of the figure was central to its appeal in every medium, but forms of intimacy provided by developing photographic technologies could intensify the eroticism of the Greek slave. This delicate daguerreotype is presented in a leather case lined with red silk and framed in gold. Like all daguerreotypes, its polished silver surface is highly reflective, limiting effective viewing angles to a single set of eyes. The best viewpoint is often achieved by cradling the encased work in one's hands. Viewing the hand-sized object inevitably becomes an intimate experience, and in such a context, the private display of the Greek slave's controversial nakedness might kindle its erotic, even quasi-pornographic, potential. As the viewer towers giant-like over tiny works of art, the difference in scale might provoke feelings of dominance. The qualities of access, intimacy, and even mastery embedded in the private, individual consumption of sculpture through new photographic technologies accentuates the sexual objectification and extends the eroticism of the Greek slave. Upon closer examination, however, it is clear that the daguerreotype does not depict one of the six full-scale marbles produced by Powers. Note the difference in the chains. Rather, this is a photograph of a statuette. It would have been much easier for photographers in American cities to access small statuettes than the full-scale marbles. Statuettes of the Greek slave were produced with varying degrees of fidelity to Power's originals in a range of materials, from alabaster and high-quality Parian porcelain to plaster copies that might be found for a shilling. As one commentator remarked, these cheaper reproductions enabled the home of the laborer to be ornamented as well as the palace of the millionaire. Of course, parsing the quality of reproductions allowed distinctions to be made among their purchasers in terms of taste and class. Douglas's statuette, for instance, while cast from a hard porcelain material, is not an especially accurate rendering of Power's figure, with slight changes to the facial features, hair, and anatomy that render the sculpture a more generic Venus and suggest that in spite of his financial resources, Douglas did not seek to acquire a particularly expensive reproduction. This cream-colored earthenware pitcher with brown Rockingham glaze from the 1850s presents Power's statue in a shallow niche outlined with a decorative arch. The niche is unusual because it has been left white in contrast to the rest of the surface. Conventional American Rockingham wares, as you can see in these images, were dipped or splattered in all-over brown glaze before firing. Perhaps the pitcher's design is a reference to the red canopy under which the Greek slave was shown at the Great Exhibition, or the specially designed niches we heard about. However, the figure in its white dome, surrounded by the mottled brown background, is also evocative of Parian statuettes displayed under glass shades in Victorian parlors. These glass shades were a practical method of protecting white statuary from smoke, soot, and pollution, as well as providing aesthetic augmentation. The irony of the decorum of placing a glass shade over a stripped and shackled female figure did not escape novelist Henry James, who remarked that the Greek slave statuettes could be found, quote, so undressed, yet so refined, exposed under little glass covers in such American homes as could bring themselves to think such things right. The picture also underscores the importance of whiteness to the Greek slave, suggesting not only notions of purity and protection, but also racial connotations. The rare design contrasts the colors of cream and dark brown, and in doing so, it emphasizes the racial dynamics of Power's original sculpture. It allocates pure whiteness to the female figure, separating it from the rich dark color of the rest of the vessel, as if to segregate out and away the brownness of actual enslaved women. A coverlet, sewn by an unknown maker in Kent, England, represents the Greek slave at the center of a matrix of commodities, like the pitcher. A pair of silhouettes of the statue flank the printed floral centerpiece, and the two fabrics notably engage features of the sculpture. On the right, the bright blue curling stripes call to mind the diagonal draping of the chains across the figure. And on the left, the large floral pattern of dark red on red accentuates the anatomy of the sculpture, with petals curving over the breasts and bands marking the waist and knees. Victorian quilt making was a skill practiced primarily by women in the home, yet it engaged and incorporated aspects of the new industrial age. Many quilt makers from the industrial middle class employed plentiful and affordable printed cotton fabrics, like those in this coverlet, made available by the rise of British textile manufacturing early in the century. The fabric silhouettes function less as copies of a unique sculptural object and more as playful riffs on a dematerialized image available for reproduction in any material imaginable. At the level of its materials, the coverlet also connects to the system of slavery that underpinned the expanding industrial world. The rise of the cotton textile industry in 18th century Britain was enabled and in large part by the importation of cotton from the slave plantations in British Caribbean colonies and the American South. By the late 1850s, when this coverlet was made, the United States accounted for 77% of the cotton consumed in Britain. Looking at this coverlet, we can think of the hands of its seamstress, but we can also think of the hands of laborers in cotton fields and in textile factories whose work is present here. The quilt reminds us that the question of slavery and modernity is not posed by the iconography of the Greek slave alone. Transatlantic slavery was fundamental to the rise of industrial modernity celebrated at the Great Exhibition, and the culture of reproduction that made the Greek slave a quintessential domestic commodity in the 19th century. Such a connection between slavery and industrial modernity was not lost on Frederick Douglass. In a speech delivered in New York on the 23rd anniversary of West Indian emancipation in 1857, he laid out the connection between slavery and industrial development in the Atlantic world. We hear and read much of the achievements of this 19th century, and much can be said and truthfully of them. The world has literally shot forward with the speed of steam and lightning. Machinery of almost every conceivable description and for almost every conceivable purpose has been invented and applied. 10,000 discoveries and combinations have been made during these last 50 years till the world has ceased to ask in astonishment, what next? For there seems scarcely any margin left for a next. I am not here to disparage or underrate this physical and intellectual progress of the race. Yet men do not live by bread alone, so with nations. They are not saved by art, but by honesty. It is in this view that West Indian emancipation becomes the most interesting and sublime event of the 19th century. It was the triumph of a great moral principle, a decisive victory after severe and protracted struggle of freedom over slavery. By studying Douglass's statuette, I've been able to determine that he did not purchase it at the height of abolitionist responses to the Greek slave in the early 1850s, but at least two decades later, when a new version of the sculpture made the manacles more realistic to emphasize the context of American chattel slavery. Three long, straight, linked bars form the chains between the wrists of this figure, confirming that this statuette, is a reproduction of the last full-scale marble that Powers produced and sold to Edwin Wallace Stoughton in 1869. The miniature chain of Douglas's statuette is made of metal and painted to match the figure and attached to small loops on the wrists. Thus, the ceramic body could have been produced to replicate Powers' altered design or manufactured years earlier and refitted with a new chain to reflect the change. Art historians Charmaine Nelson and Vivian Green-Fried demonstrate that the new manacles signaled a deliberate effort to refer to American slavery and its recent abolition, reflecting Powers' own increasingly abolitionist sympathies. Douglas's selection of this particular version indicates that he chose to own the version of the Greek slave that was the most explicit in its reference to the conditions of American slavery. It also tells us that Douglas acquired the statuette at least 6 years after the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 legally abolished slavery in the United States. And he certainly might have purchased the statuette as a remembrance of the great triumph of freedom over slavery. And yet, for Douglas, who lived until 1895, the struggle for the civil rights of African Americans remained unfinished work. As he explained in his speech in Washington, D.C. in 1886, the promise of liberty remains unfulfilled. He continues, "Lynch law, violence, and murder are as frequent as before, and without the least show of federal interference or popular rebuke. The colored vote has been completely nullified, as if the 15th Amendment formed not part of the Constitution. While I gratefully remember the important services of the Republican Party in emancipating and enfranchising the colored people of the United States, I do not forget that the work is most sadly incomplete. We are as yet a people only half free." Fully aware of the Greek slave as a vexed symbol for the abolitionist movement, perhaps Douglas chose to buy the statuette after that movement had achieved its aim to hold on to the ambiguity and the paradox of, in his words, a people only half free. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.